With that, I'll call our third and last case on our calendar this morning, case number A23-0114, State of Minnesota v. Watts. Good morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor.
I do just want to make sure that you both have your computers in gallery view so you're able to see the marshal and the time clock. Can you both see that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Excellent. As you are, I'm sure, both aware, you will be given 15 minutes for your arguments this morning. Counselor Appellant, you will get 5 minutes for rebuttal. We do just make an audio record, and so we would appreciate very much if before you begin your argument, you would identify yourselves and your client for the audio record. With that, Counsel for Appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Michael McLaughlin, and I represent Terry Watts on this appeal. Mr. Watts sits in prison based on an illegal de facto consecutive sentence that violates the sentencing guidelines and the Constitution, and that violates the state's concurrent sentencing agreement with him. Mr. Watts has been on a 10-year odyssey of institutional indifference, prosecutorial manipulation, and gross injustice. He pleaded guilty back in May 2015 under an agreement with Minnesota for a guideline sentence of 110 months. While in pre-sentence release, he's arrested on new charges in California. Then Mr. Watts, the Minnesota prosecutor, and the California prosecutor all reached a global agreement. Under it, he received 106 months on his California convictions following his pleas there, and his California sentences would run concurrently with his Minnesota sentence in this case. He would serve the two sentences concurrently in California prison. Any time in California prison would count toward his Minnesota sentence. Relying on this bi-state agreement, he pleaded guilty to his California convictions. In August 2015, the California court entered judgment that his California and Minnesota sentences would run concurrently. Mr. Watts starts serving his time in California prison. Everyone assumed that he would soon be sentenced in Minnesota. And he made multiple requests for sentencing, but it never happened. He served his entire prison portion of his California sentence, about 6 years, 10 months, without being sentenced in Minnesota. And he was without counsel for 4 years of that time after the court unconstitutionally discharged his attorney and closed the file in June 2017. After he was extradited back to Minnesota in 2022, the prosecutor claimed he was not bound any longer by the bi-state agreement for concurrent sentences. He even argued that the district court lacked authority to order credit and give effect to the concurrent sentencing agreement. Even more, he threatened additional criminal prosecutions if the court went ahead and ordered credit for the California time. The district court agreed with the prosecutor and denied Mr. Watts credit for the 6 years, 10 months he spent in California prison after his Minnesota plea. The court imposed a Minnesota sentence, guideline sentence of 81 months. By denying credit, the court made the Minnesota and California sentences de facto consecutive. This de facto consecutive sentence made his sentence 75 months longer than it would have been if the Minnesota and California sentences had occurred in a timely manner and been imposed concurrently. Mr. Watts has done his time. 7 years in California, and now over 2 years in Minnesota. If he had received his concurrent sentences that the law and sentencing agreement required, his sentence would be finished. He'd be on a farm with his wife and children, where he desperately longs to be. But because of the illegal de facto consecutive sentence, he's imprisoned and will remain imprisoned for years to come. This court must correct this unjust sentence and that extended his prison time by several years solely because of an inexcusable 7-year delay. And I'll take any questions from the court.
Counsel, you appear to argue that Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 27.03 subdivision 4B, if it applies here, that the interjurisdictional custody rule must be modified or overruled. How would we, as an appellate court, intermediate appellate court, overrule a rule of criminal procedure?
The starting point for this court's analysis, we ask be Bauman, which is a published decision of this court, which is binding on this court. And Bauman found that it reconciled Rule 27 and the sentencing guidelines requirement that defendants receive the effect of concurrent sentences that they're entitled to under the guidelines. And it determined that the guidelines-based rule against de facto consecutive sentences applied in the interjurisdictional context. no case has overruled Bauman, including Roy. Roy and Linehan and Willis and the cases that Roy referenced, none of those cases dealt with the specific issue of de facto consecutive sentences.
Well, I think Roy did. Roy is a 2019 Supreme Court case, and it talked about the application of interjurisdictional custody. Here we have, would you agree that this is an interjurisdictional custody issue?
I agree it's interjurisdictional custody, but Roy did not deal with the specific doctrine of de facto consecutive sentences. And for that doctrine to apply, there need to be two requirements. There need to be two sentences. There should be a prior sentence that remains in effect at the time of a subsequent Minnesota sentence. And there has to, the guidelines have to require that those sentences be imposed concurrently.
But in Roy on at 928 Northwest 2nd at 346, Roy did argue, just like appellant does here, that the time that she had served in the Red Lake Detention Center would transform her sentence into de facto consecutive sentences. So that issue was raised in Roy and addressed by Roy. That's the same situation here, right?
The key distinction in Roy is that the court found that there was no evidence that prior sentence remained in effect when the Minnesota sentence was imposed. So although the defendant in Roy referenced the doctrine, a requirement of all the cases that have applied it, including the intrastate cases of Dulski and Folly, and also interstate case like Bauman, in all those cases, there have been two sentences in effect. The prior sentence remains unexpired at the time the Minnesota sentence is imposed. That key requirement was not there in Roy because there's no evidence that prior sentence from the reservation was still in effect when the Minnesota sentence occurred. And Roy made that point in its in the opinion that the doctrine could not apply because that first sentence was not still in effect.
And just the Supreme Court said that that's an issue for an intra-jurisdictional custody evaluation, not for an inter-jurisdictional custody evaluation.
It did. I mean, there was language in Roy that described the concern about de facto consecutive sentences as being a concern, a factor that, of course, examined in the intra-jurisdictional analysis. But our position is that Roy did not address Roy did not present a situation when the rule against the de facto consecutive sentences could have applied, because what you need for that are two sentences that remain in effect. So although we concede that there's language in Roy that is, that does call those issues into question, but the issue was not presented in Roy that was presented in Bauman. In Bauman, there was
Supreme Court explicitly did not overrule Wakefield, correct, in Roy?
Correct. And with the way that we look at it is you have Wakefield on one side and you have Roy on the other side. And there's kind of conflicting languages in those two decisions about whether concurrent sentences apply in the interjurisdictional context and the viability of a rule against de facto consecutive sentences in the interjurisdictional context. Wakefield held that a Minnesota sentence is concurrent to a prior sentence from a different jurisdiction, as long as that other jurisdiction, supports concurrent sentences, and the Minnesota is the second one imposed.
Which is what was supposed to happen here.
Right, right.
And my question is, why aren't we obligated to follow Roy because that sentencing didn't occur? Is there anything in the law that allows us to, essentially we are asking for backdating of sentencing. Mm-hmm. And is there anything in the existing law that would allow us to do that?
Yes, Bauman. Bauman did exactly that. Bauman backdated the Minnesota sentence to the time that he served in federal custody. So that's the exact scenario in Bauman that was presented here. He was sentenced federally. He did his federal time, then was released to Minnesota where he pleaded guilty and was sentenced. This court, in a published decision, a binding decision, held that Bauman was entitled to backdating credit for all the time he served in federal, because the federal Minnesota sentences were concurrent. And if you deny the credit, it would convert those concurrent sentences into de facto consecutive sentences. And that holding rested as much on the guidelines as it did on this court's interpretation of Rule 27. That guidelines piece remains fully in effect after Roy. And Roy did not address this concurrent sentencing issue because there's only one sentence. You need two sentences before the guidelines concurrent limitations come into play. So the denial of credit had no effect on converting Roy's sentence from concurrent to consecutive. It couldn't have, because there's only one sentence in play for Roy, because that prior sentence had expired. So Roy's a fundamentally different case in our view. And what controls this court is Bauman. And Roy did not reference Bauman. Roy did not overrule Bauman. And we'd ask this court to follow Bauman here.
My recollection from Bauman is there were two prison sentences at the same time, though. It wasn't backdated.
No, that's not correct. He served his federal sentence before he even pleaded guilty in Minnesota. And then he was pleaded guilty and was sentenced in Minnesota after he'd served the federal time. And the court found that he had credit for all that backdated federal time in Bauman.
No, I think you're missing my point. There weren't two prison sentences at the same time. The state sentence occurred after the federal sentence, right? Correct?
Right, but the Minnesota court backdated the credit to count all the time he'd served in federal custody.
I think that's an important distinction, is that is whether or not there are two prison sentences at the same time. Here, there was no prison sentence. He wasn't sentenced until later.
The same was in Bauman, though. He was sentenced in federal first, and then he was later sentenced in Minnesota, and he was given credit backdated for the time he served in federal on his prior federal sentence. So I do think the cases have a lot in common, and it is controlling it. And until the Minnesota Supreme Court overrules Bauman, or until this court overrules Bauman in a published decision, Bauman is controlling authority on this court.
Well, assuming that we would follow Roy, which is binding more and more recent Supreme Court precedent, I want to raise another issue and another question for you, and that is the waiver and forfeiture issue. There's the due process issue and the prosecutorial misconduct, essentially, issue that you raise. Why aren't those waived? Because those were not raised before the district court. In order to have those issues addressed before this court, an issue can be raised, even if it's forfeited, before our court, if it is analyzed under the plain error standard. But your principal brief, and actually, I don't think even in the reply brief, it addresses the plain error standard. My understanding of case law is that if an issue isn't raised or argued before this court, then it is waived. Why aren't those issues then waived? Because they were never argued before this court under the plain error standard, which would be the controlling standard.
A couple reasons would be our position. The first is that those arguments are grounds that we assert that the sentence is illegal. That it's an unconstitutional sentence, and it's a sentence that violates what's required under the sentencing guidelines. Because it concerns legality of sentence, that's an issue that this court in the Minnesota Supreme Court has held that is not capable of being forfeited or waived. The legality of sentence can be raised for the first time on appeal. So that would be the first reason, is just categorically.
Well, can I stop you on there on, yeah, that? Because that goes more to the merits, but the state has conceded that it had entered into an amended plea agreement, but the district court never accepted that plea agreement. Can you cite to any case law that says a district court has to abide by a plea agreement, especially if it is one that is illegal, that is contrary to the law? And in other words, isn't up to the district court's discretion as to whether or not to accept a plea agreement?
It is up to the district court's discretion, but that never occurred here because it was never shared with the district court in a timely way. And part of that, and part of our argument, was that the prosecutor was not entirely forthcoming about it. But I think it's an important distinction that a due process violation where a prosecutor fails to fulfill a promise given to a defendant does not require disclosure to the court. In Santabello, the promise was not disclosed to the court before plea and sentence. In Wolski, a Minnesota Supreme Court case, it also was not disclosed. So due process binds the prosecutor regardless of whether that promise was timely disclosed to the court or not. So the fact that the concurrent sentence agreement was not shared with the district court in a timely way, that does not alter the state's due process obligation to Mr. Watts to fulfill its promise of concurrent sentencing.
But the concession made by the state, doesn't that satisfy that? I mean, the state has conceded in its brief that it was bound to that agreement and it would have had to fulfill that agreement. So violation then?
And I think there's also no dispute that the state did not fulfill that agreement. Instead, it actively argued against its own agreement. I think the only disputed issue is whether the state was somehow relieved of its obligation by either a breach that Mr. Watts made or some other factor. But we completely agree that the state was bound. And I think there's no dispute that the state did not follow its original concurrent sentencing agreement.
So I want to go back to my original question then. Is there any case law that would require a district court to abide by and accept any plea agreement? My understanding is it's still up to the district court. And generally, the parties tell the client, the defendant, it's still up to the district court, unless the district court explicitly says, I will accept that. But without that, it's still up to the district court to accept or reject a plea agreement, right?
That's true. That is true, but it doesn't change that there still is an independent due process violation if a prosecutor fails to fulfill a promise. So that as a remedy for that violation, courts have found both specific performance of the sentence promised by the prosecutor and plea withdrawal in some cases. But so yes, the district court has ultimate authority about whether to accept a plea agreement or not, but that does not in any way limit the prosecutor's obligations under due process to fulfill its promises. And that did not occur in this case. And that's the second reason. So even if this court determines that Roy bars applying interjurisdictional application of the rule against effective sentences, that promise that the state made to Mr. Watts provides a second way that this court could rectify the injustice in this case and grant Mr. Watts sentence and relief.
I have a couple of questions. I know your time has expired, but I have a couple of questions. One, could you clarify for me what happened at this sentencing hearing in terms of how this plea agreement was or was not discussed at the actual sentencing hearing, not at the post-conviction hearing?
So the October 25th, 2022 sentencing hearing?
Yeah.
So the agreement, it was, and a part, I guess this goes back a little bit to what Judge Reyes was asking. Part of the reason why I think this wasn't fully raised at sentencing was because there was still some concealment that was happening about what exactly happened with this agreement. But
my question. What information did the district court have at the time of sentencing to be making decisions one way or the other with regard to this agreement, this interjurisdictional agreement that had occurred?
The way that the prosecutor was presenting it as sentencing was that there had been, he was aware of an agreement between Mr. Watts and California that where Mr. Watts would get credit, or where the sentences would be served concurrently, and he would get credit for his time in California towards his Minnesota sentence. He used phrases like, I had no objection to them running it concurrent. You know, he did not present it as him being, or Minnesota being, a specific party to the agreement. It was more an agreement between Mr. Watts and California, to which Minnesota was aware and didn't object. That was how it was presented at district court.
What information did the defense attorney have at the time with regard to the specifics of this agreement?
He had documents from California saying that it was supposed to be a concurrent, that the two sentences were supposed to run concurrently. What he did not have are, which we got in post-conviction proceedings, was an email that the prosecutor wrote to previous defense counsel in which he specifically acknowledged that there was a direct agreement here. And he didn't have the affidavit that I got from the California counsel saying that he directly talked to Minnesota, and also an email from the California prosecutor saying he directly talked to Mr. Buehler and that there was a direct agreement. So he didn't have those things, and he didn't have Mr. Buehler saying expressly Minnesota was a party to this concurrent sentencing agreement.
So at the time the district court was making decisions at sentencing, they had no actual understanding that the state of Minnesota had signed an agreement that there would be concurrent sentences at the time the sentencing court was making decisions about the sentence here.
I think that's fair. I mean, I think like Mr. Buehler was acknowledging it to some extent. He was saying Minnesota was aware and he had no objection to it running. I mean, he did also make statements that he would have felt obligated to honor that agreement if Mr. Watts hadn't breached. So, I mean, he had moments where he came closer to it presented as a direct agreement, but I think it still stopped short of the way that he now describes it as an express agreement between Minnesota and California and Mr. Watts. And I think for that reason, the argument that defense counsel made at sentencing was one more based in reasonable reliance on the California promise. So there wasn't any privity between Minnesota and Mr. Watts from this agreement necessarily from how defense counsel understood at the time. So we framed it in terms of reasonable reliance rather than a direct due process argument that Mr. Watts was entitled to what the state had promised him regarding concurrent sentences. So I think that's part of the reason the record looks the way it is because of that. The facts hadn't been fully developed at that time.
I have one other question, which is, do we have any case law where we have applied the, you know, general rule about we can always correct an illegal sentence, where we've applied that to like a constitutional due process violation as opposed to, you know, because normally that comes up in the context of there's a problem with the guidelines, something was miscalculated. Do we have any case law where we have applied that doctrine to a constitutional problem with the sentence?
Not that I'm aware of that I can specifically cite to right now, but that is an open-ended rule that's been applied to a range of scenarios. And I just would also note that Minnesota Supreme Court has recognized that Minnesota had recognized that any sentencing proceeding must be fundamentally fair as well. So, I mean, there's the whole Betterman line of authority that the U.S. Supreme Court adopted with due process and sentencing. But this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court has recognized that there's a fundamental fairness requirement to all sentencing proceedings. And there's also the statutory, open-ended statutory powers to correct any, irregular disproportionate sentence, that language. So I think either of those could be used in this case to correct things. And at the end of the day, this just is a fundamentally unfair sentence that it's completely unacceptable that 7 years went by before he was sentenced and he's serving, years of additional time because of that. We just asked the court to find some pathway to rectify the injustice that happened in this case.
Any other questions from the panel? Seeing none. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent. You'll have 15 minutes, and I would guess people might have more questions for you as well.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Scott Buehler. I'm the first assistant Polk County attorney. I represent respondent the state of Minnesota in this case. I'm appearing from Crookston this morning. Counsel and I obviously have two opposing views in this case that are diametrically opposed. And I think this appeal really comes down to deciding two specific issues. The first is the credit for time served. And as I made clear in my brief to this court, I believe State versus Roy definitively resolves this case. The second issue is the scope of Rule 2703 subdivision 9. And the reason I say that is I brought it up before the district court. And I brought it up to this court that I believe these issues that the appellant is attempting to raise were waived before the district court, because not only were they not brought to the district court's attention, but ultimately, appellant asked the district court to impose the precise sentence that it did. And if it weren't waived, then the issue would be generally under the default standard, plain error for an unobjected to error. But counsel's taken the position that these issues can't be waived, they're not subject to plain error. And that's kind of interesting because by making that argument, he ignores existing precedent from this court. For example, This court has said in two cases, at least in published opinions, Anderson and Ferraro, that the failure to object to an alleged breach of a plea agreement constitutes a waiver of it if you go forward with sentencing and don't bring it to a court's attention. Now, counsel suggests that Santabello does away with those cases, and yet Santabello, the defendant in that case, actually raised the breach of the plea agreement prior to sentencing, and the U.S. Supreme Court later in Puckett made that clear, that there was a difference between Santabello, which had preserved the error, and in Puckett, which did not preserve the error. And in Puckett, in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court went on and applied the plain error standard review to that alleged breach of a plea agreement.
So why aren't the facts of this case different? Because it doesn't seem to me from the record that counsel for defendant had a full understanding of what this agreement had, because 7 years had passed where we had not brought this particular defendant to get sentenced for a crime that had occurred a long time ago. And so most of the cases where the waiver occurs, you have the same counsel in the short period of time. Why are those cases applicable in a case like this, where at the time of sentencing, it seems that, you know, even your recollection of what had happened 7 years ago wasn't fully in front of the district court?
Well, I just would note, Your Honor, that my arguments are summarized at pages 9 through 10 of my brief, where I did acknowledge what that agreement was. The crux of my argument was that I was no longer bound by that agreement because of a later breach by the defendant or the appellate. And
could you point to in the sentencing transcript where you informed the district court that you had directly signed on to this agreement with California prior to the defendant pleading guilty?
And I believe it's in pages 46 through 47, 55 through 56 and 58, where I acknowledge that that agreement was there, but my argument was that because of further breaches by the defendant, I no longer was bound by it. Now, this is the point where in all of this proceeding, if there was an issue about an alleged breach, I would have thought Mr. Williams would have brought it up, because he and the defendant had both acknowledged in court this agreement with California. Both of them had discussed that agreement prior to the district court only imposing sentence. That's where I keep going back to this whole thing of there's no objection ever being raised. There was no agreement for specific performance of the plea agreement. In fact, Mr. Williams's very first argument at that hearing was to argue for a dispositional sentencing departure, which had never been discussed in any way, shape, or form. Then it transitioned into the credit for time served issue. And Mr. Williams, in response to my argument, conceded that, yes, the defendant had been using heroin while he was in prison, and conceded that that was a breach of the plea agreement. Now, if that was procedurally improper, that is that the defendant hadn't been given notice, that the district court didn't make a finding that he was entitled to a hearing, those are all things that could have been raised at that point in time. And in fact, Judge Remick went so far as to say, hey, there have been a lot of issues raised here today. I'm willing to grant a continuance and that we can have a hearing to address all of these. We took a break from the record. Mr. Williams met with the defendant. They came back into court and they said, no, we want to go forward and we want to take that agreement for 81 months in prison with credit for time served that had already been agreed, that had been decided at that point in time. So there isn't anything in this record to preserve this argument. And counsel's argument that Rule 2703 subdivision 9, I think he just said, is open-ended, I would disagree with that. I would note that in this case, the defendant's criminal history score was calculated properly, so Morristead doesn't apply. It's within the guidelines range. In fact, it was at the bottom of the guidelines range. So Reynolds doesn't apply, that both this court and the Supreme Court's opinion. Didn't exceed the statutory maximum. This court earlier this year in Torres, you know, reduced the gross misdemeanor sentence from 365 to 364 days due to a statutory change. And the only other aspect of this that could have been illegal within the contemplation of the rule is the credit for time served, which I believe is dictated by Roy. But more importantly, I think the case that is on square with this case, which is consistent with this court's opinions in Ferraro and Anderson, is this unpublished opinion from this court in 2008 in State versus Quinn, where this court unequivocally stated that the rule does not apply to, and I quote, a challenge to the process by which the sentence was imposed, which this court can be waived, end quote. And that would be Ferraro and Anderson, saying that if you don't allege a breach of a plea agreement or something along those lines, it's waived. This court then went on to say that the, and again, I quote, express acquiescence, end quote, to the sentence that's imposed by the district court amounts to a waiver of an alleged breach of a plea agreement. Now, that narrow interpretation of Rule 2703, Subdivision 9, is consistent with the authorities that I just recently cited to the court in a letter of a supplemental authorities that point out that these types of rules that most states and the federal courts have are meant to be very narrow rules, narrow exceptions to either waiver or forfeiture, which is the way they've been treated in the past. You know, I'm the one who argued the case in Morrison to the Supreme Court. I argued waiver and I argued plain error. And they said, no, based upon the policies underlying the sentencing guidelines that require a correct calculation of a criminal history score, a correct guideline provision or guideline range, those don't apply. They've never, and I'm not aware of any case from this court or the Supreme Court saying an alleged breach of a plea agreement or something along those lines are preserved under Rule 2703, Subdivision 9, be raised at any time. In fact, it would require an overruling of this court's opinions in Ferraro and Anderson to reach that conclusion. But then subsequent to that, you've got the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision and Blondheim reaching a similar decision. I will tell the court that this is the point in all of this that I find most interesting is, had appellant actually argued the waiver and forfeiture for the district court, we actually could have addressed whether the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Puckett should be the framework that we should be using in this context. That is an unobjected to claim that a plea agreement has been breached. The U.S. Supreme Court explicitly adopted Puckett. Counsel's view was plain error doesn't apply whatsoever. And in fact, that's the position he took at the district court level. That's the position he's taken now. I think it's an interesting argument, especially since the Minnesota Supreme Court in recent years has recognized the distinction between waiver and forfeiture. But when counsel refuses to address plain error, it ends up being waived on appeal, because otherwise the only way you could develop a plain error argument is if you're going to do counsel's argument for him. And in State versus Levy, this court basically said, hey, if an issue is subject to plain error, you don't address it, you've waived it. So I don't believe 2703 Subdivision 9 services counsel's arguments. There's been all kinds of issues that have been waived with regard to sentencing. And it is the delay in sentencing, that due process argument, certainly would have been an argument, interesting one to raise under Betterman, because it's never been addressed by any of the courts in this state so far. There's all kinds of different issues about how do you measure prejudice. I would just note that the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals in 2020 in Deck versus Jennings basically said that Betterman hardly sentences the question when it comes to delay in sentencing. Because it was dicta in that case. It wasn't even before the court. It was a Sixth Amendment case that the court rejected in Betterman and went on and just say, but hey, due process does place limits on this. But it was never raised before the district court. So what counsel wants you to do is find the district court erred when it accepted the sentence that had been agreed to by both of the parties in this case.
Counsel, I want to go back to a question that Judge Larson had, and I just want to try to get a little bit more clarification. My understanding of the record is, and the record's fairly extensive, there are a lot of emails and communications back and forth, but my understanding is there was an amended agreement that had been reached between you as the prosecutor, the California prosecutor, and defense counsel. And in fact, the California court acknowledged that and stated that the sentences should run concurrent based on an agreement with the state of Minnesota. I want to jump ahead, and that's in 2014, 2015. I want to jump ahead then to the sentencing. What exactly did the district court understand that there had been originally an amended plea agreement that had been reached between all of the parties?
I don't believe that was ever brought up at the beginning of the hearing, because Mr. Williams immediately jumped into a dispositional sentencing departure argument. So it wasn't brought up until later on, where I acknowledged that but for this subsequent breach by appellant, I would have been legally obligated to recommend concurrent sentencing with credit for time served in California, even if that amounted to an illegal sentence under Roy. So it comes up, but it doesn't come up clean at the very beginning of the hearing, because Mr. Williams started out with this dispositional departure argument, which took the first, 20 to 30 pages of the sentencing transcript.
you have to support the idea that you can unilaterally rescind a plea agreement on the basis that you, the prosecutor, have determined that the plea agreement was breached?
No. And to be honest with you, if I had to do this all over again, I mean, I would have filed a separate notice of breach of the plea agreement based on what was stated by the PSI, as well as I should have asked, once Mr. Williams got done with his argument, saying, "Your Honor, that's another breach of the plea agreement. We need to address this." But it ended up getting caught up in this whole thing. I made my arguments, based upon what was in the
pre-sentence investigation. But you agree that you don't have authority to independently decide that the plea agreement is breached?
Absolutely, I don't.
And so you would agree that you had an obligation to then ask for concurrent sentencing at this hearing?
Correct. Until such time that a breach had been found, I brought it up. Mr. Williams conceded it. The district court was never asked to explicitly rule upon it. This court's had an unpublished.
But as an officer of the state, did you have an obligation to inform the district court with regard to this, regardless of the defendant or defense counsel, as an independent officer of the court who is a party to this plea agreement?
Inform the district court of what, Your Honor? That we should have stopped and formal breach?
That you had to ask for concurrent sentences under the agreement that you signed.
And I did. I believe that's exactly what was stated in there, except that I made the argument because there was a further breach of the plea agreement. But for that, I would have been obligated to recommend credit for time served in California, even if that amounted to an illegal sentence. And I believe that was a quote that I made.
But you're now conceding that you did not have the legal ability to find a violation of the plea agreement. Well, so what you represented to the district court is different than what your legal obligations were, correct?
Well, maybe I'm misunderstanding you, Your Honor, because my argument got tied up with the fact that we went through the pre-sentence investigation. There were no objections to it. That's where the defendant had conceded that he had used heroin in prison, had been drinking pending sentencing. So then when we get after Mr. Williams goes through his dispositional departure argument, and to be honest with you, at that point in time, I thought it was pretty clear that there was no agreement between the state and the defense, because I don't know where the defense would have come up with an argument for dispositional sentencing departure that had never been an option. And so when I brought up the idea that there was further breach of the agreement, Mr. Williams conceded that he had used heroin and that was a breach of the agreement. He only disputed whether the defendant had been drinking pending sentencing. So at that point in time, yes, in retrospect, I should have asked the court for clarification, but given Mr. Williams's concession that yes, in fact, the defendant had been using heroin, yes, in fact, that's a breach of the agreement, and Mr. Williams was not asking for specific enforcement of that agreement. And that at that point in time, I don't think there's anything before the court other than to say, okay, I agree with agree that with the concession provided by the defendant, that there's a breach of the plea agreement here. Now, if we had to do this all over again, I'll tell you, I would have probably taken Judge Remick up on his recommendation that we break that hearing and continue it and not go forward with sentencing, even though counsel wanted to go forward with sentencing under the new agreement at that point in time. It certainly would have made a much better record in which we could have addressed all these alleged individual breaches of the agreement, of the plea agreement, and had a clear record going forward on appeal. But there is one thing I wanted to bring to address with regard to you, Judge Reyes, and that was the idea that, you know, I mean, Judge Remick seemed like he was not exactly crazy about the fact that this agreement had been reached. And it was not, and just to clarify, it was not reached between me, defense counsel in Minnesota, and the prosecutor in California. I only spoke to the prosecutor in California initially about, hey, I would be willing to go along with this. It was after the fact that I spoke to appellant's first counsel, which would be Mr. Alexander. And at that point, I said, yes, I've agreed to this, but also we have not dealt with the breach of the plea agreement, and that had never been contemplated by the California agreement. In fact, the prosecutor in California acknowledged that. The only discussion had been with regard to concurrent, not with regard to any alleged breach of the agreement. I see I'm out of time, and the only thing I wanted to say was I think Bauman is clearly distinguished from the facts of this case.
I do have a couple of questions, and I'll also see if the other panel members do as well. My question is, do you agree that had Mr. Watts been sentenced in a timely fashion, that Wakefield would have applied in this case?
No, because for two reasons. One, first of all, the Minnesota Supreme Court said in Roy that Wakefield only applies to the idea of concurrent sentencing, does not apply to credit for time served. And so
that's why I'm asking if we assume for the sake of argument that Mr. Watts had been sentenced 1 month after the California sentence, would you agree that Wakefield would have applied?
Well, I go one step further, Your Honor. I would say that I would have been under an obligation to apply Wakefield and give him that credit going forward, because that was the amended agreement at that point in time. I don't know that Wakefield can be extended that far with sentencing to another state. It was a federal case. I still find it kind of interesting in that the Minnesota Supreme Court in Wakefield says the statute by itself, 609.15, subdivision one, clearly applies to state sentencing within the state of Minnesota, but we're going to apply it going forward in a broader manner.
But you agree that the Supreme Court did not overturn Wakefield and Roy?
No.
And that Justice Thiessen's concurrence makes pretty clear that the court was not deciding the viability of Wakefield in Roy.
Correct. And I think what Roy distinguished Wakefield away in that case.
And so you would agree that had Mr. Watts been sentenced in the timeline we would normally sentence a defendant, that there would have been an application of Wakefield and he would have been getting a concurrent sentence?
Well, and I'll just, like I said before, I would say that I was legally bound at that point in time to recommend that he be receive credit for the time spent in California going forward. That is true, and I think that's a fair application of Wakefield. But once that sentence has been completed, Wakefield no longer applies. And I just would note that this court distinguished Wakefield and Jurdy, basically saying Wakefield no longer applies after a defendant has been released from custody. Counsel wants to extend Wakefield to supervised release, probation, parole, things like that. I'm not aware of any court in Minnesota having extended Wakefield in that fashion.
I do think that part of this argument is that the fact that someone dropped the ball here, whether that's the court, whether that's defense counsel, whether that's your office, in terms of it being 7 years before this person got sentenced, that that's what has created this issue where the defendant is serving consecutive sentences, where if timely sentencing had occurred, he wouldn't be. And that you seem to be admitting that had sentencing occurred earlier, there would have been consecutive sentences here.
And I do. But again, when we go back to the sentencing hearing in this case, that's never brought to the district court's attention in any way, shape, or form that there was a violation of due process. In fact, the argument is for something entirely different. And when it's all said and done, I go back to the fact that the sentence that the district court imposed was the very sentence that appellant and his counsel asked the district court to impose. No objection, no error preservation, nothing. So you're basically being asked to find fault with the district court for accepting the very agreement that was proposed and agreed to by appellant and his counsel. And again, I think this would have been a classic case for raising an ineffective assistance of counsel claim with regard to Mr. Williams for not raising any of these host of issues that appellant has later, but that claim has never been made. There is no claim of ineffective assistance of counsel whatsoever in this. I certainly would have been interested in hearing what Mr. Williams had to say about these legal issues after the fact that weren't raised at the time of sentencing, but counsel has not raised that claim against any of the three attorneys who represented appellant during the course of this case. And Judge Reyes,
any other questions? Thank you, counsel, for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, thank you. Just initially, I think it's an important factual distinction. Mr. Bueller makes this argument that he only raised his claim of breach after there was a concession regarding chemical use. But he actually asserted in his pre-sentencing letter that he wasn't bound by the concurrent sentencing agreement because of the California conviction itself. So, and that was before there was any basis for him to find that that Mr. Watts or his attorney was admitting breach. He said in the pre-sentencing letter, "I'm not bound by this concurrent sentencing agreement because of the California conviction itself." So I think that undercuts the credibility of his claim that when he made that unilateral decision that Mr. Watts was in breach and he wasn't bound by the agreement, that he was somehow responding to events as they occurred at sentencing. He'd already decided to do that before sentencing on an even more dubious legal basis that was the California conviction itself. And then a legal point I think is important to make is forfeiture looks at the facts as they are known to the defendant at the time when the issue could have been raised. So we have to look at what was known to defense counsel at the time of sentencing. The due process argument, there was nothing in the record to show the reasons for delay at that time, which is an essential element of the Betterman analysis for a due process violation. And in this court's recent argument in Johnson that dealt with a due process issue with sentencing delay, it focused on the failure of the record to show the reasons for delay. And that was the argument suggested that was failed of the claim. So here, there wasn't an essential piece of the due process analysis that existed on the record. So defense counsel was not in a position to raise due process at the time because he didn't know that the delay had been caused by prosecutorial misconduct and by the judicial errors that led to the delay in this case. And similarly, for his failure to fully articulate the breach argument, that he didn't know all of the facts regarding Mr. Buehler's involvement in this agreement. And then another point is that the 81 agreement, the defense counsel's recommendation for 81 months was made after he lost his argument on credit for California. It was after he lost his departure argument. It was after he lost his argument that he should receive the credit because he relied on the California promise. So he got Mr. Watts the best sentence he could after those adverse rulings. Those adverse rulings themselves are what preserve those issues for review. He doesn't need to keep on objecting. It doesn't mean that he can't agree to any sentence. He raises issues. He lost them, got adverse rulings. That preserves it. He can ask for an 81-month sentence at that point. It's the same as any defendant who argues for a departure. Loses on the departure, a defendant always asks for bottom of the box. It's exactly the same. You don't waive a legal argument by subsequently trying to get the best result in light of those adverse rulings. And that's what occurred here. The Puckett case is distinguishable because there the parties knew all the facts at the time when they failed to raise the issue of breach. Here the parties do not know all the facts. It's also a key point that Mr. Buehler acknowledges that if this case had been sentenced in a timely way, concurrent sentences would have happened. It would have been required under Wakefield, it would have been required under the agreement. He takes the state out of the fact that sentencing was delayed. He is the passive voice. Sentencing was delayed. What happened here was the state delayed sentencing. The court made an error that delayed sentencing by 4 years. The state made what is essentially an illusory promise that it was never intended to enforce that Mr. Watts would receive credit for his California time. Those are the key facts that delayed sentencing. So it was not some just, cosmic event that the state had no control over. They are responsible for this. Mr. Watts deserves to have credit for that time because he would have received that credit if this case had been sentenced in the normal course in 2015. I'll answer any other questions that the court has.
Are there any other questions? Seeing none, thank you to both counsel for your argument in this case.